I feel a scream, so I hold my breath and push it down, like when I have to get rid of hiccups. Meanwhile, my mom starts to ramble. She tells Dana Blakely how hard she's worked with me to improve my communication style, which was not true. It was TV and Keller and Ian and my family at the Triple S that got me where I am now. But I was told not to say one word, and so I don't say one word. Everything I've learned from my mom has been in spite of her. She tells Dana Blakely about my math skills and about my taking classes above my grade and my SAT scores. She leaves out how hard I've had to work for those things because that would be too ordinary. And if I'm going to be seen as extraordinary in any way, as worthy of protecting, it will be in this way. A savant like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. Then she tells Dana Blakely how she had to get me out of this mess because I was headed to college. I was getting out of this shithole, not getting trapped like every other person who's ever grown up here. And then she asks Dana Blakely if she grew up here, and she tells her, someplace like it. And my mom says, so, you know, look at you now. You're a lawyer. No chance that would have happened if you stayed in a place like Sawyer. Dana Blakely is very interested in my lopsided seesaw and my mom's obvious take on our entire situation. She asks her if there are any medical records on file about me. I know exactly which story my mom will share, and she launches right into it. She tells Dana about the time I was admitted to the psychiatric unit because I wouldn't stop training for marathons and had become dangerously underweight. She tells her how scary it was because social services got involved and Dusty was so embarrassed he brought in a special doctor to treat me. All of that was now in a record with the state and also in my medical file, and I will never be able to get rid of it. Dana Blakely looks at me because my brain has become so hot I've started to cry, which I only do when I'm mad. And this makes me madder and my brain hotter, and so more tears fall. And it's all just one big, horrible shit show. Dana Blakely speaks in a very soft, even voice. She asks me if I knew about the camera in the dining area, and if I knew if there were other cameras at the Triple S, inside or outside. She says Clay Cooper was required by law to tell us if we were being watched while we worked. And I tell her that I did not know about any cameras. Technically, she says, the one in the dining room doesn't reach into the workspace, so he didn't have to tell you about that one. I assume if they had any footage from the back room, you wouldn't be here at all, because they would know what did or didn't happen at the store last night. She pauses now, because this is the obvious time for me to say what did happen, or at least the part that I might know. But I don't. I made promises. My mom sighs deeply, like she wants to reach inside my mouth and pull out the story. But then she realizes she may not like it, so she stops herself. Me being me might be useful after all. Instead, she asks, how do they know the body was moved? Dana Blakely says that it could be many things, like the amount of blood they found at the scene or the way the blood had pooled inside his head. Maybe it wasn't consistent with him being struck there on the side of the road, then falling to the ground and bleeding on the street. She says it could also be from surveillance cameras in town. Maybe someone caught an image of his truck on its way back to his neighborhood. And after they do the forensics, they may find other things like dirt or particles that came from somewhere else, not the street or his car. And I think that she must have learned all of this from TV shows because she said she wasn't a criminal lawyer. And because I knew all of those things from TV shows, and so would my mom if she watched anything besides Real Housewives. So he was killed somewhere else, then driven in his truck back to his house? Dana Blakely shrugs. They don't have to tell us anything, so all we can do is guess. They might even be lying about the body being moved. Right now, Charlie is just a possible eyewitness, not a suspect, certainly not a defendant in a case. There are no disclosure rules. They don't have to tell us anything, and we don't have to tell them anything. That much I know. I represented a corporate officer once who witnessed a robbery. My mom doesn't look at me because she's returned to her thinking. What about your phone? Dana Blakely asks. I pull out my phone and place it on the table. Have they asked you for it? I shake my head no. Good, she says. They'll have your call and text logs soon if they don't already. They got a warrant based on the camera footage, but the actual content of the texts will take longer. You don't have to unlock it. I nod. Now my mom does look at me. What will they find, Charlie? On your phone? I shake my head. Nothing unusual, is all I say, and that's the truth. Everyone I called and texted that night would be on my phone any day of the week. But it still sits there, the question they're both waiting for me to answer. My mom hasn't asked because she doesn't want to know, and the lawyer hasn't asked because she's trying to win my trust or make it seem like it's my choice to answer when I'm ready. But it's coming. It has to be. The moment where I decide who I am. And then it does. Charlie, my mom says. Tell us what happened last night. What did you hear in the back room of the Triple S? What did you see? I look at them, these two women with wide eyes and hungry curiosity. I consider what Dana Blakely said about there not being any disclosure rules, about me not being under arrest, just a possible witness. I've already looked this up myself, and I know that people don't have to say what they see, even a brutal crime. They can make me sit here like a good girl. They can do all of that. But what they can't do is make me speak. Not a word. Not one single word. I did not kill Clay Cooper, and I don't know who did, but I do know that people I love are about to be suspects. And once I open my mouth about one single thing, they will want to pull the rest of it out. Things I've observed and things I know about people who trust me. If I open my mouth and if I say one single thing, I will then have an impossible choice to make between lying and breaking that trust. So, I will not say one single word. I am not a liar and I won't betray my friends because, rule number 5, once you betray a friend, you lose them forever. Chapter 10.
May we come in?
Yes, yes.
Thanks for your patience. We've just had a look at your phone log. There are quite a few texts between you and your friend Keller Joelle last night, the night Clay Cooper was killed.
Did she need your help with something? It looks like she texted first. Maybe you could just unlock your phone and show them to us. We'll get them at some point.
Look, we know all about Keller's family, you know. The Joelles. They've been in the system for many years. Keller is the sort of girl who might get into some trouble and who might need someone like you to help her, don't you think?
What does that mean? Someone like you?
Someone honest and loyal, dependable. Someone she could trust.
May I ask, since I'm just getting up to speed here, what is the situation with this girl, Keller, and her family officers?
Keller Joelle was a truant. She left school after 9th grade. She has a boyfriend who's 22, mother is deceased, no father to speak of. You get the picture.
Oh, please. You don't know anything about it. That girl dropped out of school to take care of her sick grandmother because her own mother died of cancer. And because she has no father, and her half-brother could care less about anyone but himself. And because the state won't pay for the right medications. So don't you dare put down a girl who does that, who sacrifices her own future to care for a woman society has thrown away. Don't you dare.
Look, we didn't mean to judge. I apologize if it came out wrong. We're just noting that Keller Joelle has a complicated life. We know that she also works 2 jobs, both for Clay Cooper. She has shifts at the Triple S and at the diner downtown. Now, We're going to interview every employee at both of these establishments. So if there was any tension between Keller and Clay Cooper, we're going to hear about it.
What about her boyfriend, Levi? You must know him, Charlie. He works across the parking lot from the Triple S at the gas station. If Keller had trouble with Clay Cooper, I imagine a strong young man like that might get upset, want to protect his girlfriend.
Or was it something else she needed? Money, maybe?
My client declines to comment at this time.
Okay. Well, what about the call to this 526 number? It's not traceable, which means it's a phone someone doesn't want anyone to find. Calls, location, nothing.
My client declines to comment at this time.
And the call at 10 p.m. to Clay Cooper.
Jesus H. Christ. You called Clay Cooper?
My client declines to comment at this time.
Charlie, you don't need to be scared. You're not a suspect here. But we can see from that footage that someone else was at the shop last night, and that what they were doing or saying in the back room was upsetting you. It's admirable, Charlie, wanting to protect a friend, but it's not the right thing to do.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, be aware that this is an ongoing investigation and that we will be looking into these calls and texts, analyzing the footage from the Triple S, conducting forensic examinations.
With proper warrants, of course.
Of course. But we will find out who killed Clay Cooper. This town won't rest until we do. He's the head of our council, a board member of the church, and the largest property owner in the county, which means he signs a lot of people's paychecks.
Oh, so it's more important to find out who killed Clay Cooper than someone else in this town? What about old Mrs. Watkinson, who died of a heart attack after a break-in scared her literally to death? And the clerk at the gas station a few years back, shot in a robbery? That case was never solved. And even Colin McGuire, run down on the highway by a stolen car? How many hours has this department logged looking for him this year? Or last year, or the year before. But for Clay Cooper, you won't rest until there's justice?
We're just saying that his murder is likely to involve a lot of suspects, many of whom your daughter is connected to. People won't take kindly to that fact, that she's not saying what she knows.
You know something, detectives? I have found that giving a shit about what people take kindly to is a waste of time. Because they're always not taking kindly to something.
There is one last thing. We found an incident report in Keller Joel's file from last June. It was a report made by someone who claimed to be concerned about bruises found on Keller's arms and neck. Keller said it was from a fall she had at her house, tripping down the stairs. But the woman who reported it thought the injuries might be consistent with physical abuse, possibly her boyfriend. But now, it makes you wonder, does it not, if it might have been someone else?
Who made that report?
We can't reveal that information. But it was someone who was close enough to see them regularly and to know about her daily life. It was a credible source.
I'll bet. It was that Janice woman at the Triple S. I know it. She's such a busybody.
I think we're probably done here.
Okay, but please remember, Charlie, we are going to find everything that's on your phone, and we are going to figure out what was going on with Keller and Levi. Soon, we'll even know who was in the back room of the Triple S with Clay Cooper while you hid under that counter.
Yes, yes, we know all that, Detective. You've now told us several times. Here's my card. Please contact me if you have any more questions for my client.
Of course. We'll be in touch. Have a nice afternoon.
I knew it. I knew that Levi was no good. And now they've dragged you into this mess. Ugh! Although, they could just be working an angle, right? This could be nonsense. Smoke and mirrors? to protect the Coopers.
What do you mean?
Well, Regina Cooper just told us that the IRS is investigating her husband. They may even have a warrant by now.
The IRS? Did she say what it was about?
No, but they're looking into his businesses. I bet he was cooking his books, and they finally caught him. Son of a bitch.
Charlie, do you know anything else about this? Has there been any talk at the shop?
No, nothing like that.
And nothing unusual going on with the business? No strange people meeting with Coop? Changes in routine? How the register is handled? Is there a manager there?
Yes, her name is Nora.
Is there anything different about her behavior lately?
No.
Are you sure, Charlie?
Yes.
Charlie, look at me, in the eye, and say it again. Say that you don't know what this IRS business is about.
I do not know what the IRS business is about.
She's telling the truth. She's a very bad liar.
Okay, I'll tell the detectives. Maybe they can find out, and maybe that will turn attention away from Charlie.
Yes, that's the thing to do. Let them focus on someone else. Miss Blakely.
Yes?
You don't think Charlie's in any danger, right? I mean, if Coop was doing something illegal, she's just a girl. A kid. Right?
Chapter 11. Dana Blakely goes outside to execute our new plan. This day feels like it won't end. My mom calls Dusty from that same corner, and my thoughts return to the question Regina put in my head while we were all in the bathroom. Who may have wanted Clay Cooper dead? I continue making the list because it's impossible to stop now. I need to sort things out. 1. Janice. 2. Nora. Nora knew things, maybe too much, about what was going on with Coop and his shady record keeping. Nothing kept on computers, no paper stored in the office, no spreadsheets, not even to track the pans of food we went through each week so we could get better at the ordering. Well, none that he knew about. And Nora is wise. She didn't go to college, and she never left Sawyer, but she was married to a man who died in the army, and this gives her a kind of wisdom that you can't get in school, or even just from being old. She didn't trust Coop, because she learned to see the world through the eyes of a widow. Coop said his methods were necessary because of agencies like the IRS, the entire government even. He explained it all to me one afternoon at the SSS. Coop was convinced that one day the government was going to seize all the banks and all the companies who traded in the stock markets, and then the stock would be worth zero. And he said they would take all the money in the banks as well. He said cash was king, and one day we would all come running to him for a loan. Turns out there are people who fear the government more than anything else. They talk about places like Cuba and Venezuela and hide their money under their mattresses. It didn't take much research to make my own decision about whether my money was safe in the bank and in an account that allowed me to pay fewer taxes. So Nora taught me how to file my tax returns. She said, "Don't mess with the IRS." It was like a giant beast with no head. Once it got its hands on you, it would just squeeze you until you were dead and nothing you could do or say would make it stop. The best thing to do was to report all of your income and pay all of your taxes on time to stay out of trouble. And in my case, putting the money into the 529 plan allowed me to legally avoid taxes and the headless beast that collected them. All of this explained why Nora kept those spreadsheets. And other things as well, about the register receipts, the payroll, the rent, insurance, taxes, and whatever else she could find, all on a thumb drive that she slipped in and out of the laptop when she knew Coop had left. She worked a lot of late nights. And I'm not the only one who knows this, it turns out. When Dana Blakely returns for the last time, she tells us that the detectives promised to keep the security footage a secret if they could. But when she mentioned the IRS and Coop's possible shady books, they told her that they also knew about Nora signing the documents and staying late to work on those books. So maybe she was the one cooking them. And maybe she and Coop fought about this last night. And maybe she killed him. Then Dana Blakely explains to me what I already know. Everyone is eventually going to find out about that recording they have, and that it proves you heard something and maybe saw something. And the trouble for you, Charlie, is this. The person you're protecting might be grateful, but it sounds like there are also people you could be hurting by not talking, and they are not going to be happy. They are going to be angry that you won't exonerate them. She looks at me with serious eyes as she moves on from Nora to another member of my family at the shop. I know about the fight Coop had with Janice yesterday. An employee already told the police about it, and about her husband punching him, getting fired, and then rehired. There's a history there. Dana Blakely gives the details, which I already know, though I'm not at all happy that someone told the police about it. And I know who it was. Tracy worked the dinner shift last night. It had to be him. He's weak like that. The snarky kid who talks shit but then collapses into a pile of it the second he's confronted. You see what I'm saying? Nora often stayed late to sort the books, books that might soon be under investigation. Janice left in a rage after Coop ridiculed her child. And Keller, she reached out to you for help last night. They have the texts and, well, they're going to find out what happened if they don't know already. Here we go. My mom perks up because she has this thing about Keller. Found out what? What else about Keller? Dana Blakely tells us with a heavy, remorseful sigh. There are rumors, I'm told, about Clay Cooper dating young women that work for him. Was Keller one of them, Charlie? Is that why she was upset last night? Was she dating her boss? Now my mom gasps and covers her mouth. Oh, Jesus H. Christ. Oh, and she had those bruises. Dana Blakely goes on to explain how everyone was talking about Clay Cooper today, things she overheard in the lobby and just now from the detectives, and most of it was probably gossip, rumors, word of mouth, shit talk. Coop employed lots of pretty women, young women, and he flirted with them, ogled them, supposedly dated some of them in exchange for better shifts. It could all be nothing. It could be things he talked about with his friends when they were drunk at his club or playing golf or at the old warehouse he owned that he supposedly used for illegal poker games. It could have just been talk. But my mom is shaken as she processes this information and puts it into her own mental files, very large files, about the inequality between men and women, especially in towns like ours. And I'm sure she thinks about her lost dreams and our shitty apartment and the man she has to tolerate in her bed every night. And while her mind is doing all of that, Dana Blakely is finishing her own thoughts. You can't save them all by saying nothing, Charlie. The best you can do is save the ones who are innocent by telling us what you know. You need to be honest, Charlie. You don't have a choice. If you tell me, I can work with the police to get you a deal. My mom nods her head in agreement now. The two of them discuss how to make it work without me getting in any trouble or ruining my college admissions by having all of this come out. And I stop hearing them. I can't save any of them without saving all of them, because I don't even know which one I'm saving from what thing. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onion. I need to get back to the Triple S. Chapter 12. My mom is silent the whole way home, which gives me time to think more about the people who wanted Clay Cooper dead. First, Janice, because he used his second hand to take away her pride and her dignity and that of her husband and even her child, poor little Ollie. Second, Nora, because he put her in a position that could expose her to criminal charges for crooked bookkeeping and who knows what else when she's all about personal integrity and honor, and also this job, which has been her whole life since her husband died in the army. Third, Keller. Keller has been my best friend since we started elementary school. Ian was my next best friend, and all three of us were inseparable until life started to change. We had nothing in common aside from the fact that we all had broken families. And by broken, I don't mean single-parent homes, divorced parents, common things like that. Ours were broken in ways that become plots in novels and movies. The ones that make people think and cry. The ones that make people think, thank God that isn't my life. That was the glue that held us together. I learned that I had a broken family like that in the fourth grade. I remember it was a Tuesday because they always served meatloaf on Tuesdays. I had asked a girl in my class if she wanted to come over one day after school. I'd asked her the week before, and I figured 7 days was enough time to wait for an answer. In the fourth grade, kids still just say whatever they've been told. They don't have filters yet, at least not good ones. So she told me she wasn't allowed to come to my house because her mother couldn't be sure that my mother ran a home with the right values. Even with Dusty and their boys, I was a reminder of my mother's past that made her a different snowflake. I never told my mom about the playdate thing because she would have shit an enormous brick. And she would argue that it didn't matter about the past. She put our family back together with Dusty and the boys, but it wasn't the same. It's never the same. Dusty didn't love me, and I didn't love him. We were like the pictures the TV shrinks use to diagnose their patients, where there are some things that belong and one that doesn't, and they ask, which one of these things doesn't belong? Like a bowl of fruit with one potato, or a rack of boots with a pair of high heels. It was subtle, but still obvious if you bothered to look closely enough. My mom belonged to me, Dusty, and the boys. The boys belonged to my mom and Dusty. Dusty belonged to my mom and boys. I was the only one who just belonged to my mom, like a cancer that can be cut out without killing the patient. Ian's father died when Ian was 7, and his mother never remarried, which seemed acceptable since she had already been married and had a child. She had proved herself to be normal. With Ian's family, there was also a tragedy hanging over them, and that garnered sympathy from the community. Sympathy is better than scorn. Still, they were broken in a way that reminded people of sadness and loss, and nobody likes that. Ian's family was broken like a heartbreak. But Keller, her family was broken in the worst possible way. It was broken like a TV set that's thrown from a window 10 stories high, its pieces littering the street, metal and glass and plastic everywhere, injuring anyone too close when it hits the ground. Broken in an ugly, messy, shithouse way. Her mother had 2 children without being married. The first was a boy named Ricky. His father lived in Boston, and now Ricky had his own wife and 2 kids himself. Ricky moved just far enough away from Sawyer to make it impossible to help with their grandmother, Dot, who has 12 physical ailments along with her dementia. She wears adult diapers, a life alert necklace, a brace on her leg, and an oxygen tank that she wheels around from room to room, all while leaning on a walker. Keller says she could be a spokeswoman for pretty much every old age product that's ever been invented. Plus Marlboro Reds, which Dot won't give up. One long infomercial. One giant billboard right next to the hand of God and the triple S. except for the fact that it was so painful to look at her that people might crash their cars. Keller and her mom lived with Dot until Keller's mom died of breast cancer when Keller was 13. Social services came to see what to do about Keller, and she lied and said her dad was going to come live with them because she didn't want to have to live with some rando foster parents, and she didn't want Dot to be sent to a state facility. The last time that happened, they gave her the wrong medication, and she tried to cut her wrists with a butter knife in the cafeteria. Things had not ended well between Dot and Keller's mom. She didn't even go to her funeral. Keller's mom and my mom had a lot in common, but Keller's mom didn't have babies until she was 19, so there was that difference. But they both got called whores by their own mothers, and I think that should be its own special club where everyone in it gets $1 million and can live their lives without men like Dusty or shitty apartments or cancer. But I don't make the rules. Instead, there are people like Dot. She is unforgiving and believes, even now, that her only daughter is burning in the eternal flames of hell for what she did. 2 babies out of wedlock and 1 with a married man. Keller had a plan. After 9th grade, she stopped going to school so she could make the money needed to keep living in her house with Dot. I got her the first job at the SSS, which wasn't hard because Keller is the kind of girl Clay Cooper liked. And after that, he let her work at his diner as well. She was a woman, really, in every way, especially in her spirit and determination. She cared for Dot like my own mother cared for her boys, and Janice cared for Ollie and her 3 other children. Keller learned how to cash Dot's social security checks and pay the rent and the utilities, and even how to file all of Dot's medical claims with the government. But she was also a woman in other ways. She moved through the world in her body like she'd had it forever, the breasts and hips and pouty lips, like she had never been anything but a woman, and the kind of woman who turns heads. Coop was disgusting around Keller, and all of us hated him for that. His eyes lingered, his mouth gaped, that spot on his balding head got shiny with perspiration. He stood too close to her, brushed her behinds with the back of his hand when he squeezed past her in the service area, which he only lingered in when she was working. Keller said she was used to it. She said he wasn't the first old geezer to ogle her, and she was right. Coop wasn't the only man who wanted to touch Keller. This is the part about Levi from the gas station. It was at the end of that first summer that a tall, beautiful man came in for a sandwich. He was a cross between Dallas and Soda Pop from The Outsiders, which every teenager has to read. He has a bad boy exterior with an innocent inside that all made him irresistible. He walked across the parking lot from the gas station, where he'd just gotten a job as a mechanic. He was 20 then, and had moved here from New Jersey. He'd come looking for work, which makes me think New Jersey must be even worse than Sawyer, if that's possible. I remember seeing him in the line, then seeing him again as my eyes took over my brain. That's how beautiful Levi is. He stood patiently, waiting his turn, and when Keller asked him what he wanted, he stumbled over his words, barely able to look at her, which made her blush and look away, and then made him do the same. Keller stood next to me at the wood counter where I was making a tuna salad pita with lettuce and onions, and she said, "I think I just fell in love." That was over 2 years ago. And in that time, 3 things have happened. First, Levi and Keller became inseparable. They became best friends. They became lovers. Second, Janice started to notice bruises on Keller's body. And then so did Nora and I, because we all started looking for them after Janice told us. Janice eventually told the police as well about the bruises and about Levi. All of this confused me. I thought about the times Keller and I lay across the hood of her car under the hand of God, drinking beer so my mind would stop spinning, and she would tell me about their bodies being one. And I just could not reconcile that image with the story Janice was telling about the bruises. One second, Levi stroking her face and gazing into her eyes, and the next second, grabbing her arm so hard he left them black and blue. Once I started looking for the bruises, they seemed to be everywhere. There was the one on her cheek, the one on her neck, the one on her ankle. But then I thought, what do I know about any of this? Keller also said there was something powerful when she and Levi were together like that, a feeling of being overpowered by his strength, which she said was exciting. And maybe that's what caused the bruises. Maybe it didn't hurt when it was happening because she was so excited by the rest of it. I only asked about it once, and she said she fell and not to worry. I did worry, but what can you do in a situation like that? Coop was not happy about Levi and Keller, even though Keller was too young for him and he was married. His flirtations took on a new flavor. Suddenly, she was something he couldn't have, not because of his own self-control or his priorities like his family and his reputation with the town council and the church, but because of another man. And so whatever fantasies he'd allowed himself inside his head, well, those had been stolen right out from under him. He cut back her hours. He put her on shifts that made it hard for her to care for Dot and to see Levi. He threatened to fire her every time she was late, which was almost every day because she was always being pulled in different directions. And he touched her wherever and whenever he wanted, tempting her to make a scene so he could have a reason to fire her. The look on her face when she felt his hand run across her thigh while she was prepping the food or mopping the floor. I don't have the exact word to explain it. Vacant. Dead. Resigned. Back in the prep room, Janice would sometimes bite her lip until it started to bleed, because, as her husband Shane once said, we all had to eat whatever pile of shit Coop served up for us. Levi could kill Coop with his bare hands, but if he did, we would all suffer. So he saw what Coop did to Keller and heard about what Coop did to Keller and couldn't do a thing about it for the same reason Janice couldn't and I couldn't and Keller couldn't. Coop got whatever he wanted. The third thing that happened since Keller met Levi has nothing to do with Keller and everything to do with me and what I knew about Clay Cooper. It happened one night after my shift at the Triple S. I had just turned 16 and finally had my driver's license. My mom was in the kitchen with the boys. She was cooking them dinner, and they were watching TV, which meant Dusty wasn't home. When I walked in, she was mumbling to herself the way she does when she's really, really upset. I opened the fridge to get a soda. She grabbed my arm. I need to talk to you. She put two plates of chicken nuggets and apple slices in front of the boys and pulled me into the family room. It's happening, she said. What's happening? I asked. It was Dusty. He was having an affair and getting ready to leave her, only she wasn't going to let that happen. No way, no sir. I have a plan, don't you worry, she said. I was just 1 year away from getting into college and winning the town scholarship. What happened in this house was so close to not mattering, I could feel it in my bones like the shiver of excitement you get on Christmas Eve before you know the truth about Santa. Still, she carried on, telling me about his late nights and his excuse about some case, but how she checked at the courthouse and the case had already gone to trial, so it was over until the judge made a ruling, which could be months away. He always slowed down after a trial. Only not this time. This time, he was using it as cover to have an affair. She knew it.
Take the car, Charlie, she said next. I can't leave the boys, and also he'd see me and know I was out looking for him. But he wouldn't think anything if he saw you. He'd just think you were meeting friends. Take it where? I asked. I was tired. I wanted to have a shower to get rid of the grease smell from working the grill and the pickle juice stains on my fingers from stocking the pans for the next day, and then watch some shows and go to sleep. But no, that's not how my night would go. My mom told me about the place where they go, the people having affairs, how it was just over the border in the next town, how it was a Marriott hotel with a restaurant and bar in the lobby and not a family place, but a place for out-of-town businessmen who wouldn't recognize anyone from here.
No one local goes there for any other reason. It's overpriced and the food is terrible. Just the businessmen from out of town and the teenagers trying not to get carded. And the cheaters.
Mom, I tried to complain, to stall, to tell her she was crazy because, after all, she was so beautiful. And like she was always saying, Dusty couldn't afford to leave her now because she had two kids with him and had become accustomed to a certain lifestyle which he would have to keep her in if he left. He couldn't afford to do that and also provide a nice life for another woman. She had been telling me this for years and years. But it was no use. Half an hour later, I was parking the car at the Marriott. She was right about that place. I had no idea it even existed, and there were a lot of license plates from neighboring states. I walked through the lobby and into the restaurant. I still smelled of grease and pickle juice. I was still wearing my jeans and the Triple S t-shirt. I didn't find Dusty that night. When I told my mom later, she seemed more disappointed than relieved. I began to wonder if she'd been hoping for a reason to leave him that would put her on the high road and him on the low road. Like maybe she wanted a divorce with alimony on the side and sympathy poured over the whole thing like hot fudge on a Sunday. I didn't find Dusty, but I did find someone I knew. A couple was sitting in a small booth way, way in the corner. It was the back of a man's head, the scruffy hair on his neck, and the pattern it made as it crept from his hairline until it disappeared beneath the collar of his button-down shirt, the shiny bald spot. Even the shape of his ears, the way they protruded farther from his head at both the bottom and the top, make the letter C on the right side and a backward C on the left side. It was Coop. And sitting across from him was a girl I knew from the diner. I guess she was a woman, because she was 19, and she was dressed like a woman, and she was acting like a woman, the way she held her wine glass and laughed like she was actually happy to be there with a man like Clay Cooper. And it was then, too, that I knew why she got all the dinner shifts where people paid more money and tips, while Keller only got breakfast and lunch if she was lucky. And just like the curiosity that had grown inside me from Coop's strange record-keeping, a new curiosity was born. I could easily imagine Keller sitting at that table with Coop, too. And now that she was 18 and still with Levi, and Coop kept cutting her hours at the Triple S and at the diner, making her desperate for money, well, it seemed like it was only a matter of time before Keller could be the girl at the Marriott. So, yes, Keller had reasons to want Clay Cooper dead. I guess, by association, so did I. Chapter 13. When we get home from the police station, my mom cooks while I have a shower. Dusty has taken the boys out to the park, and when I hear them come home, I get nervous. Dusty is not going to be happy with me. I stay in my room until my mom calls me. I come downstairs and take my usual seat next to her on my right side, with the boys across from me and Dusty at the other end. He calls it the head, although I don't see how there can be a head when there are two ends to the table that are exactly the same. But in Dusty's house, there is a head, and Dusty sits there, a king on his throne. Dinner always starts with a prayer, and we have to hold hands in a circle like we used to do in nursery school. I know it sounds normal. Maybe it even sounds nice. But for me, it means touching my mom with my right hand and touching Dusty with my left hand, feeling their skin on my skin on both ends of me, and it makes me feel like losing my shit. On this night, though, Dusty does not reach for my hand or for DJ's hand on his other side, and everyone seems a little confused. We all just follow his lead and let him say his prayer, thanking God for the food while we stare at our hands folded in our laps. When he finishes, we look up again and my mom starts to pass around the food. Tonight, tuna casserole and peas. She didn't have much time to cook since we were at the station so long. My mom asks about the park. The boys shrug and say it was fun, and Dusty goes on and on about all the things they did, like throwing balls and playing tag with some kids they knew from school. Dusty says he ran into so-and-so, and my mom says that's nice, and nobody talks at all about Coop being dead and me being recorded and getting hauled down to the station for questioning. Dusty decides to speak then.
"Did you tell them?"
he asks my mom. She doesn't answer. She gives him a look.
"Because they should know. It might help, even if we have to take her back to the hospital."
I stop chewing and forget to swallow. I sit with a mouth full of mushy tuna casserole, which is not pleasant, but I can't move my mouth or my tongue or any part of my body. I'm frozen, thinking about what Dusty has just said. Finally, my mom says something. "That won't be necessary." But Dusty is not satisfied.
"How do you know? I mean, this was just the beginning, the first interview. What if they come back with more questions? What if they find more evidence?"
My mom shuts him down. She sees my mouth full of food and my cheeks getting red. "Hot head, hot head, hot head.
Charlie, drink your water."
I do as I'm told. And she's right to tell me, because when I drink the water, I have to swallow, and then at least that part is over.
"Eileen, I'm serious. If this blows up and the college finds out, they could withdraw her from acceptance. And then what? What will she do then?"
Now he cares about me going to college? Now he wants to help?
This is horseshit. "Don't you remember when she started running?"
Rule number 12. People tend to repeat the past. I was 11 when my mom and Dusty's second boy was born. Their first was named Dusty after his father. We call him DJ because he's technically Dusty Jr. DJ sounds like the name of a jerk. I hope that doesn't happen because their DJ is a sensitive boy and I actually don't mind him. The second one started growing a year after DJ arrived. My mom said she wasn't messing around. Two babies in 2 years made it impossible for her to go back to work, and that made her a stay-at-home mom, and that made her a candidate for alimony, and that made it all worth the effort. Dusty was with her when DJ was born, and he didn't like it one bit. He looked like someone had ripped out his eyeballs and scrubbed them with sandpaper, then put them back in his head. So when it came time for the second one to be born, he went on a golf trip with the partners from his firm. He said he couldn't get out of it because it was one of those team-building things where they're all supposed to get to know and trust each other more so they work together better. But there were only 5 of them, and they were all men, so all they were going to do was play golf, get drunk, talk about porn, then jerk off in their hotel rooms. My mom told that to one of her friends, a woman named Leah, who liked to come over with her baby and pass the time by putting the babies in one room together, drinking coffee, and talking about their husbands and the other women at the club. Leah laughed when my mom said this. It turned out Dusty planned the trip and decided the timing on purpose. And when my mom found out, she made him sleep in the guest room for a whole week, which I don't think he minded. My mom is not fun to be around after she has a baby. This baby, named Everett, after Dusty's dead father, came at night, the way babies like to do. My mom woke me up. She told me she was having the baby and I had to go with her to the hospital. She said we were dropping DJ off at Leah's house, but I had to be with her in case she needed me. It was already decided, and I could tell it had been decided the second Dusty told her about his mandatory golf trip. The hospital was not crowded, and they took my mom into a room right away. I sat in a chair in the corner and stared at the muted television that hung from giant metal hinges on the wall across from my mom's bed. There was a commercial playing, only it never ended. It had an old woman with blonde hair and perfect teeth speaking with pleading eyes and a serious mouth. And I could tell she used to be someone important, like an actress, because why else would she be on the commercial for so long when she wasn't very attractive? Behind her were emaciated children, walking around in the dirt, their eyes hollow like they were already dead. The camera zoomed in on one, and I could see flies buzzing around the baby's head. I couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl, or even the age. Nurses came and went. They put wires and tubes into my mom's arms, and she was not happy when they told her it was too late for some medicine that she wanted. She yelled at them and even swore at them to give her the medicine because no way in hell was she doing this without it. They left to get the doctor and she started to cry. Her eyes found me and she summoned me to come to the side of the bed and take her hand, which I did. But my eyes couldn't leave the flies eating that baby's head. And so her eyes followed mine until she also saw it. Then she said, "Look at that, Charlie. Those poor women forced to have babies they can't even feed. Don't ever forget it. Because even though you don't live in that place, you'll turn this place into that place for yourself if you don't listen to the things I tell you." Then she asked me if I understood, and I lied and said yes, when really I couldn't put one single thought together. The pain came again, and she let go of my hand to grab the railing on her bed, and she screamed so loud I had to look at her. I wondered how this kind of pain wasn't killing her. How much pain did it take to kill someone? It didn't seem like there was much more pain someone could ever feel, even when they were dying. Alarms went off, people rushed in, nurses and a doctor. A man. He told my mom the baby was coming and they pushed me aside. Then they strapped her feet in the metal stirrups and pulled off all the sheets and gathered between her legs. You know the rest, except for this part. While it was all happening and she was screaming and yelling at them for not giving her the medicine, the pain subsided for a moment and they told her to rest and catch her breath. It was then that she looked around and found me. And she told me to watch what was happening to her, to remember what was being done to her body, how it was being tortured and ripped open, and how this was the most pain she would ever feel in her life. "Never forget this, Charlie. Never, ever. This is all God's trick." And then the pain returned. I couldn't think about anything while I was watching this thing happen to my mom, with the flies eating the baby going on in the background. There was nowhere to escape to in that room. When the baby ripped out of her and they cleaned it up, wrapped it in a soft, cuddly blanket, and placed it on her chest, she cried again. Only this time with joy. I had learned the difference by then. And she kissed it and stroked its face and said it was a miracle. She called me over and said, meet your new brother, Charlie. Isn't he beautiful? But I would never forget. I would never forget how much pain she endured, how much strength it took to push that thing out of her, and how angry it made her that she had to endure all of that, even though she could, even though she'd now done it 3 times. I would never forget how she cried when she kissed his face, and how I knew she would love him forever, as fiercely as she loved me, whether she wanted to or not. And I would never forget the images of the flies eating that baby's head because the mother couldn't find enough food or enough strength to keep the flies away. All of that became a new rule. Rule number 14, God's trick, whatever it was, is a very, very good trick. It was all of this remembering that led to the running that Dusty had brought up again after so many years. Because not long after, when we were all back home and Dusty was made to sleep in the guest room, my mom and I cuddled on her bed while she fed Everett. She had been tending to both her babies day and night. Everett screaming in the night for feeding, DJ screaming in the day because he wanted more cookies or TV or for no reason whatsoever. My mom tried to hold them both, together or one at a time, all through the day. She was ragged, but she still kissed their faces because she couldn't help herself. I didn't know what to make of this except to see that she was under the spell of God's trick, which was bigger than even she knew. And I watched this carefully too, like a spy gathering intelligence. Watch and file, watch and file. You'll need this one day. I sat beside her on the bed and she showed me her swollen breasts and told me how the milk was stored there and how it came down and squirted out when she heard the baby cry. And wasn't that crazy how biology works? She stared at me then and told me to come closer, on the other side of her. She reached out her hand and touched the front of my nightgown where my own breasts would have been if I'd had them. I flinched, but then steadied myself because it's not okay to flinch when your own mother touches you. I felt her hand brush over my nipple, though I didn't call them that, even in my mind. I didn't call them anything because they were irrelevant to me. She brushed over one of them and then paused, pressing her fingers into my skin like she was feeling around.